Okay, so welcome. I'm going to give an introduction for Judith, and you can hear me online in person, okay? All right. How about online? Can you hear me all right? I'm over here in the corner there. So my name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. And so we're very happy to welcome Judith to Sims and to offer the Dharma and also to share her book. So we're very lucky to have her. So Judith has been, you know, take a look at my notes here. She's been a Dharma teacher in the Katagiri, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Roshi Zen lineage. And she studied under him for some 17 years. And she was also instrumental in founding the Clouds and Water Zen Center in St. Paul, where she was a guiding teacher for 9 years and is currently a senior Dharma teacher emeritus. She's also been a professional modern dancer and is a doctor of Chinese medicine. So a warm welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, just a couple quick words in terms of orientation. Those online, if you could refrain from chatting, Judith, it just gets a little distracting. If you have any concerns, you can chat either the tech support or Cheryl. Yep, that'd be great. And those, it's probably better to send to tech support, Kathy, I should say. And then here in the room, our policy with masks, it's optional. And so we just respect everyone's choice to wear or not wear a mask. So I see many people wear a mask, and that's wonderful. If you don't want to wear a mask, that's fine too. And I think that's it. Okay, thank you.
So good evening. We're going to do a little bit of a meditation just to bring us all in the room. But maybe I'll add a little bit of an introduction. So I've been in Zen for 50 years. That shows you how old I am. And I've been a student. I've taught. I've studied from different traditions. And I was a very, very good student. I did everything they told me to do. And what I'm going to talk about is kind of my reflection now after doing everything they told me to do. And some of it was absolutely fantastic, like a gift of an enormous proportion to study Buddhism. And other things I'm now a little bit more critical of or skeptical of. And this book kind of arose out of the mishmash of all my reflections. On the one hand, feeling completely indebted to Buddhism for saving my life. And on the other hand, feeling like there were things that weren't being said that I needed to have said. And unfortunately, I'm the person who's saying them. I just noticed the moon is very, very beautiful. And it's right over there. Do you see it? Yeah. That's quite lovely. Okay, so under the beautiful moon, let's connect with the universe and with each other. So it'll only be maybe 10 minutes of sitting. And I'll do a little guided sitting. I know that I'm at an insight Vipassana tradition place, and I mostly studied Zen. But I do have a Zen version of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, because Zen often teaches through images. So why don't we find a place how we want to sit or lie down or stand up? And we'll start to enter a quieter space. So just allowing yourself to arrive right now and right here. And it's the end of the day, so we have a lot of energy and things about the day that are probably lingering. And just allowing yourself to be exactly the way you are right now. And the time of day to be what it is. And bring all the different parts of yourself into the presence if you can. And we'll start with just grounding ourselves. Of course, the first ground is to ground in the present moment. And the second ground is to be in your body. So just noticing where your body is at right now. Feeling the sensations in your body. And feeling your body releasing to gravity, relaxing into the chair or the cushion. And connecting yourself with the ground or the earth. Feeling the bottom of your feet and whatever sensation you have connecting with your chair or your cushion or the floor. And the image is still as a mountain. Mountains are firm. They move, but they move in archaeological time. One thing I love about mountains is that they accept all things. They accept the trees and the streams and the beauty. And they also accept animals and people urinating on them. Whatever it is, good or bad, the mountain receives it. So just letting ourselves receive what's ever in our bodies, receive the emotions of this moment. Whatever this moment is, let's try and receive it. Still as a mountain. A mountain is such an expression of equanimity. And the movement in the body, easiest to feel it is the breath. So just turning our attention to our breathing. And the image for this is the waves of an ocean. The ocean coming in and the ocean going out. And the next instruction is to notice your heart. And what is the melody of your emotions? The emotions are singing to us, high and low, songs we like and songs we don't like, but they're all the expression of our humanness. And holding or surrounding or being aware of the melody. And I like to hold it with gentleness and kindness. Just allowing the song to play, but to have enough awareness, just a small amount of awareness, to hold it in the compassion for the human condition. Whatever it is. Still as a mountain, infinite as an ocean, song like the bird songs in the trees. And the last is mind like the sky. So just opening to the space that humans live in. And our thoughts are like clouds passing through the sky, but behind the clouds is this vast, quiet, open space. So this spacious silence holds and cares for and attends to all the movement. And the whole thing, the whole meditation, rests on our intention, whatever your intention for your spiritual life is, that's the rock, the basis of what we're doing. And in my tradition, we have what we call the three pure precepts. Do good. Don't do harm. And free or help yourself and others. Do good, don't do harm, save all sentient beings. Do good, don't do harm, save all sentient beings. Do good, don't do harm, save all sentient beings. I surprised myself by singing. So I'd like to start kind of just an extension of meditation. I'd like to start with my gratitude. So I'm so deeply grateful that I had the time and the money to study Buddhism. I'm so deeply grateful that I had the time and the money to do psychotherapy. I'm so deeply grateful that I had the time and the money to study nonviolent communication. And I'm so grateful that I had the time and the determination to do 12-step recovery. And I know I can say I'm grateful, but I know that this is also because of my position in the society that I was able to do all these things. So with my gratitude, I'm also acknowledging my privilege. And what I think is kind of funny, or not funny, but really shows something, is that 12-step is somewhat dismissed or kind of made fun of. And it's the only one that's free and accessible to everybody and all the time. So that's a lot of indication about our structure, you know. So I wrote a book called Untangling Karma, Intimate Zen Stories on Healing Trauma. So, why did I write this book? Because there are a lot of people like me, I believe, that enter Buddhism with a very disturbed emotional body. Disturbed by trauma, sexual trauma, societal trauma, the trauma of oppression, many, many things. Sometimes I think, oh, we should just say dukkha. We should just call it trauma nowadays. Even just living in the society is a type of deep emotional disturbance. So I wanted to write about that, because I wasn't hearing about it that much at Dharma centers or anywhere, really. So I wrote a very frank book. I mean, some people think it's startlingly frank. And the reason, there are a couple of reasons. I realized one reason is I've been in 12-step as long as I've been in Buddhism. And it's very frank there. If you've ever gone to a 12-step meeting, people just say it like it is, you know. So this book is kind of like that. I just say it like it is for me. And also, I've been an artist since I was been little. And one of the concepts that I have about art, and I'm not sure it's correct or real or not or truthful or not, but one of the concepts is that if you go really, really deep into your expression or dig into the things kind of you're not supposed to dig in, that if you do that, those things can become more universal. They'll start to be not just my story, but a lot of people's story. And so that was the premise in which I wrote the book. Dig, dig, dig. Truth, truth, truth. Oh, it almost made me cry. Say things you don't want to say out loud and put them down. Now, thankfully, I had a marvelous and wonderful writing support person. So I didn't write the book alone. I wrote the book with this wonderful writing mentor who helped me shape the book so that I don't believe the book is just journal because of her. And it does have a shape to it. And I didn't really understand the shape until I had finished the book. I started with, oh, these are just a few interesting stories that I have about my life in Buddhism and as a woman teacher, the first generation of women teachers, these stories. But now I know that the overall themes of the book are They kind of move through the whole book. And one of the themes is, I'm just going to say it. It's kind of a critique of the male-centered patriarchal Buddhism. And I'm not saying that's bad. That's what it is, you know, that it was made by men, for men, and usually young men. Like, what, 16 to 30 years old were the men who were in the monasteries in the olden days. So how does that apply to me as an American, as a woman, as a Jew, as a mother? So I kind of started by taking back stories, which I think is a kind of women's way, maybe too, that we teach and talk about our stories, and we're more emotionally available in that way to talk about the story. And in the Buddhism that I grew up in, of course, it's changing in the 21st century. So, you know, because I'm an older generation, I learned in the 20th century, mostly. So I'm hoping that it's changing, and I hope my book is part of the changing and the encouragement that we have to change the structure of how we practice Buddhism so that it's more inclusive, that and includes stories. So what I learned when I was in Buddhism, what I learned was that I am supposed to disidentify with the story. And in the end, this is completely correct, that we have to disidentify with the story. However, the way I was going about it was not deconstructing the story. It was kind of suppressing the story, bypassing maybe my feelings, and learning how to concentrate so well that I didn't have to deal with my stories. But what I have found is that if you do that long enough, and I've been in long enough, that it will goose you in the end. The parts of yourself that you split off because they were too painful to deal with, they will come round again. They're not dismantled unless you dismantle them. And I found that I needed to go into the stories, deeply into the stories, to understand them enough that they actually started to dissolve. So in the end, this book is totally about stories, but in the end, I've dismantled the story. I would like to tell you that after all these years, I finally feel free of my stories. And it happened because I went into them, not because I disidentified with them, even though that was the result. Now, as I say this, I want to bring up my other, it's humorous, I think. I only want to say I'm 80% healed, or I'm 80% enlightened. And I'm fine with that. I'm ecstatic with that. Yay! You know, Buddhism presents this 100% thing, that you're going to be enlightened and everything will drop off. In Zen, we call it dropping off body and mind. But that's not been my experience. There's been moments where I feel that way, or moments in a meditation where I understand emptiness. But they're just moments. And then when you come back, there you are with your stories. So what I'm hoping to present is you have to do ascending spirituality and descending spirituality. And they work together. And of course, that's the duality, right? So we're going to have to learn how to embrace both of them, and both of ascending and descending work mutually together. They're not actually separated. It's like going into the story. Ironically, I let loose of the story. So this is the irony of when the dualities start to work together. You can't hardly separate them anymore. So in my feeling, being 50 years in Buddhism, even though my tradition, all these traditions teach non-identification, what they teach is non-duality and no preference, and everything is one, working simultaneously together. But what I have found is that there is actually a bias. There is a bias towards emptiness. There is a bias towards transcendence. There is a bias towards more meditating and more monastic practice is the way to go. And I'm here to say I don't think that's true. I think, of course, our traditions give us so much. And meditation is so important in understanding how to be in the here and now, in grounding yourself, in releasing these traumas and pains and ouches. But we also have to bring forward again how to descend. And I know I've given this talk a number of times, and I know that a lot of people don't want to use the word descend. They have an aversion to the word descend. And I'm very consciously using it. That, you know, it's like there's a myth. I wish I knew. Persephone, I don't know exactly what myth is, but they go into hell. And if you're strong enough, you can come back out, right? And in a way, I feel like that's what happened to me with this book, is I let myself go into the pain of my stories. And because of my transcendent work, because of Buddhist practice, I was able to come back out again. Does this make any sense? Okay, good. Katagiri Roshi talks about meditation. He's passed on now, but he used to say it's like chewing the cud, like a cow. So something happens in your life that you're not able to digest, and the cow would make it into a cud and stick it into different parts of their body. And then when they had time in the field, they burp up the cud and digest it. So I think this is a really good metaphor for meditation, that we have these things that happen in our life that are too hard for us to handle at the time they happen. We stick them someplace in our body. And in our case, in human case, we don't want to deal with them. You know, so maybe they get stuck in there forever sometimes. But I think if you meditate, what happens, and many of you who are meditators know this, that they will, you will burp them up and start to metabolize the pain that you've received in the past. And you can chew and grind it out. So that's the beauty of meditation, is it's the pause that helps you chew the cud. And also, if you're learning kindness, loving kindness, as part of your meditation, you can hold that whole experience with kindness. So that's what I learned from Buddhism or from meditation. But what I had to also do was psychotherapy to learn what all those, what happened. So let's see what I want to say next. So there's, let me just jump into systems. What I found when I started to go into my stories was the pain of my story always was held in a systemic situation. So when I was able to see the larger picture of my pain, and also to see that it wasn't only my pain, it's lots of people's pain, that was a way that I began to dissolve the me, my-ness of my hurts. So, for example, let me just say, one of the main reasons, motivations for writing the book was my students started to call me Roshi, which is the mature, highest level of being a Zen teacher. And I was very flattered and lovely, thank you. But when I went home, I was still had a lot of anxiety, like a churning in my stomach. And I didn't know, what is this from? I've done all this psychotherapy. I felt like my personal karma had been digested. I had worked on the sexual abuse I had as a child. Come on, how much, what is this that it's still there churning? And what I discovered in my exploration was it was intergenerational trauma that my body was still holding. So how do I handle that? What do I do to release that? So at the time that this was happening, well, even earlier, there were certain things happening in the Buddhist community that went to places and let the place be the teacher. So I went with, Bernie Glassman, who is a very famous Zen teacher. He also has passed. And he was going to Auschwitz-Birkenau on retreats. And I thought, wow, this is what I should do as a turn-away Jew who's now into Buddhism. But I'm still holding this turmoil in my stomach. So I went with Bernie, and the first chapter of the book is about this exploration from World War II. And I went there with him, and it was, well, he calls them plunges, because you go to these situations where your frontal lobe is just knocked out. It can't hold what happened at this place. So it's just your heart opening and trying to see the dukkha of the world, the pain of the world, that this could happen. And it was at that, in that situation, where I began to understand my churning in my stomach. You know, the scientists say that trauma actually changes your chromosomes. The telomere of your chromosomes change, and that goes to the next generation. So I'm the generation right after World War II, and I feel like that unmetabolized trauma that happened to my people was 80% still in my body. So that was really an incredible experience. And I'd like to read something. So part of my, what I called my trauma, was my dad's rage. He was a very angry man, and he was also charming. There were good things about my dad, but he really raged, particularly at my brothers. And it was very traumatic to watch, to witness. And I didn't, there's so many things I've had to learn as an adult because I didn't learn it in this violent family of mine. But when I was at Birkenau, I forgave my dad. And the reason I forgave my dad is because I saw what the causes and conditions were of his trauma. So if we really look at the causes and conditions, that's called karma in Buddhism. If we look at those causes and conditions, that is the way to release them. So let me just say something about forgiveness, because that's a big word. I don't think you can will forgiveness. I think forgiveness is kind of a grace that happens. And it happens after about, 85% of your metabolizing. You don't forgive in the beginning. You have to metabolize, digest what happened. And maybe when it's about this big, can you see that? Yeah. Then all of a sudden you have grace and you forgive. And it comes not from me. It doesn't come from my ego. It comes from the higher energies that help me to release what my ego has been holding on to so tightly. And I also, I've learned the forgiveness meditations from Vipassana community, and I love them. And they are fertilizer or tilling the soil. But until you've metabolized most of it, you won't get the grace. But they do help till the soil, make you ready, see that it's possible to forgive. And it's kind of like love. I used to think I had to produce it or I had to forgive. But what I've seen is if you metabolize your pain, it will come to you. You can receive the love from the universe, or receive the forgiveness from your higher selves, will be able to forgive. So this is a paragraph about forgiving my dad. Standing in the middle of the Birkenau concentration camp, I realized the causes and conditions that had made my father my so-called enemy. And he became a human being in my eyes. I saw beyond my limited and preconceived intellectual understanding of who my father was and the conditions that had shaped his psyche. My heart opened to the causes of my father's rage. It struck me like lightning in a moment of insight and release as I was moving in a long stream of retreat participants toward the front gates for a lunch of bread and soup. All of a sudden, with no warning or intention, I found myself dropping to my knees, my head bent over, and my hands on my heart. People were streaming past me on both sides as if I were a rock in a stream, the water rushing past. In this moment, out of time, huddled forward over my knees, I forgave my father and I asked him to forgive me. Crying and howling with grief for my ancestors, for my parents, and for me, I saw the many repercussions of the violence and dehumanization that had happened in Birkenau and in my people's lives and their connection with my own life. So one of the hopes I had for the book was that if I investigated and expressed the psyche that happens for an oppressed person, that if I did it deep enough, that would extend to other people who were oppressed, African Americans and Native Americans, and that the psyche of oppression is kind of similar, even if we're different races or different experiences. And one of the things about oppression is you begin to believe the oppressor and you hate yourself and many other things, right? And this is the kernel, the deep kernel that needs to be opened and released, because that is just a symptom of oppression and it's not the reality of who you are. And when Buddhism dismisses the story or people's identity or people's ethnic backgrounds, I don't know if you can get to the freedom, because that's such a important inner psychic structure. And I have felt, as I taught and for myself, that in order for us to see or feel this no self, which is what Buddhism teaches, we have to go and see what it was, the construction of our ego. What were the causes and conditions that made that, to feel the pain of that, and then to allow it to dissolve? And that's a lot about my defense mechanisms. I still have them, so I'm going to hold up the 80% card, and I'm going to say, it wasn't until I really understood the repercussions of being a Jew in this society, I wasn't able to take down my defenses, which is what Buddhism is all about. Taking those down so that the energy of life can go in and out and up, and that you could be free. And so I did a lot of work on this. One of the other chapters is about my relationship with African Americans. And I also did what Bernie Glassman taught me, was I went to place. So I volunteer, I still do, at a African American not-for-profit for Black men ages 18 to 30. And I'm often the only white person there. And that has been a enormous teacher for me, revealing my prejudices, showing me where my lack of understanding of another racial group. And with that group, I went to Ghana, and we studied the international slave trade from Ghana. We went to the slave castles, which was very, very similar as going to Birkenau. And when I came back, I went to Montgomery to just investigate, see how I felt bodily. It's a visceral thing. I didn't just study from the books, you know. So I went to that wonderful Legacy Museum in Montgomery, and I wrote this chapter, and I was really afraid as a older white American woman to write a chapter about race. Felt very, very challenging, but I'm happy I did it. And the basis of that chapter is my love, I'm going to say it as crudely as it's coming to me, which is my love for the maids. So I always had an African-American woman raising me as a domestic help. There's one statistic that in the 1950s, 90% of African-American women were in domestic help, were maids. And I fell in love with Melissa, and I made a pact with Melissa that she got cancer. And this was in the 80s, I think. And the idea of doing Buddhist hospice first came out from Stephen Levine and Joan Halifax. It was even before the AIDS stuff that San Francisco Zen Center started to do. So I made a pact with Melissa that I would go with her to her death. And I was at her death in Greenville, Mississippi. And this is a story in the book. And when Melissa died, I was on one side of the bed, and her daughter by birth was on the other side of the bed. And her daughter by birth had been left behind down south to be raised by her aunts. And I was the young woman who got Melissa's care up north. And that was the kernel. I had to understand this karma. How did this happen that I was on one side of the bed and Alicia was on the other side of the bed? So that's that chapter. I really dug in to race relations and these stories of going to Africa, of going to Greenville, Mississippi, etc. So in a way, I did like a body scan. I know you guys know what that is in the Vipassana community. But instead of doing a body scan, I did a hate scan. Or a resentment scan. Where do I still hold hatred? Or where do I still have resentments? And the book is kind of the exploration of that. I call it an exorcism of hate. So one of the main themes of the book is to study the pain of the consequences if you study the pain of the consequences, holding them with kindness or holding them with universal perspective, but studying the consequences, you will be able to experience the pain as energy, and that energy becomes the stimulus for action, loving action. That's from Bernie Glassman too. Start with don't know mine, which is throw away all your ideas and concepts. Bear witness to the pain of yourself and others. And then from the bearing witness, you might get a small idea of what would be a loving action to do. And I wrote a chapter on sexuality. That chapter, that's the only chapter in the book that I don't want to ever read again. But I know I'm going to have to. But that was a very difficult chapter for me to write. I was very frank. So let me just say, if you are a trauma survivor yourself, you have to go at your own pace, moving at your own speed. So, for example, if reading the book or reading that chapter brings up too much for you, then don't read the chapter. Skip that chapter or go on to something else, or come back to that chapter a year from now after you've done some more metabolizing. But you have to go, especially with trauma, you have to go slowly and you have to go at your own pace. And I think your own pace is related to how much trust you have developed. Trust in the universe, trust in the natural order of things, trust in yourself. And that also goes along with kindness. If you're going to open up your pain, you have to meet it with a lot of kindness and gentleness. And if you don't have that yet, you have to retreat and you have to build up your sense of kindness, and then you can go back in. So I was very happy when the Me Too movement came out, of course, like, okay, now at least we can talk a little bit about it, and at least the world is talking a little bit about it, and maybe those men are going to go to jail. They're not always men. Maybe those people will have a consequence for what has happened. But my chapter goes into that is a given that we might be able to say, I have experienced this. But what I did was talk about the lifelong journey of healing. It's a huge journey if it affected you the way it affected me. And I didn't even have the most severe sexual abuse that I know other people. It's not just women, but other people have had. So I haven't read that many books or that many articles about how you heal, you know, and what your partner has to do, the poor dear. So I bow to my husband because I said to him, you better read this chapter, you know. I can't put this out into the universe unless you say, okay. And my sweet and loving husband said, that's fine. It seems like it's pretty clear. And I didn't totally go into his stuff, you know, thankfully. But my stuff is his stuff, right? So that was that chapter, really trying to talk about how hard it is to heal and how long it takes. And again, I'll just say 80%, because I still have flashbacks or things like that, but I hold them in such a different way than I used to hold them. And in that chapter, another really fun thing about that chapter is there is, it doesn't seem like a fun chapter. Well, one fun thing about the chapter is I went to the koans of made by women. Koans are stories, puzzles in the Zen tradition. And there, I think it's 13th, 14th, and 18th century stories of women Zen practitioners being sex positive. Instead of celibate, shave your head, don't talk about sex. Even when you're having kundalini experiences, you can't talk about it. That drove me bananas as a trauma survivor, that I couldn't talk about what was happening in my body. That was, again, you know, I need to tell you what's happening in my body. And the teachers, I think this is true also in Insight tradition, that they say, well, go and take a walk, or that's not what's important. Ground yourself. In the meantime, you're having these wild orgasmic things happening and you can't talk about it. I don't think that's right. I think that we have to be much more transparent, more like that. Gee, I wonder if maybe I should read something. I'm just going to read you. This is a big koan, so there's a whole introductory part and there's a post part, but I just want to read you the center part. And I'll see if I can. So there was a woman practitioner. This is a 12th century woman. And she had a dharma relationship, not a sexual relationship. She had a relationship with the head teacher who could see that she had dharma in her, or that she was a wonderful practitioner. So he let her into the monastery. So the only woman in an all-male monastery. And the head guy, we call it an Eno or a Tanto. I'm not sure what you guys call it. But the head guy was really mad and said, what are you doing bringing this woman? She's going to disturb the whole place, you know. And so the teacher said, well, you should go and have an interview with her. So this is the story of the interview. Wanan reluctantly agreed and requested an interview. Myozong said, do you want a dharma interview or a worldly interview? So already she's setting him up, the dharma as opposed to the world. You know, when actually what happens, they're completely simultaneous in the present moment. Okay. But she, and so he replied, a dharma interview. Myozen San said, then send your attendants away. She went into the room first, and after a few moments, she called, please come in. When Wanan entered, he saw Myozong lying naked on her back in the bed. He pointed at her genitals, saying, what is this place? And Myozong replied, all the Buddhas of the three worlds, the six patriarchs, and all great monks everywhere come out of this place. Maybe I'll go on because it's so great. Wanan said, and may I enter? Oh, God, he totally didn't get what was happening. And he sexually objectified her, right? May I enter? Myozong replied, horses may cross, asses may not. Wanan was unable to reply. Miazong declared, "I have met you, senior monk. This interview is over." And she turned her back to him. Wanan left ashamed. Later, the head teacher said to him, "The old dragon has some wisdom, doesn't she?" So let me end with talking about kintsugi. So kintsugi is a Japanese craft. One of the reasons I entered Zen and love Zen is because the Japanese aesthetic is so beautiful, Japanese art, and it's really through Zen, poetry, teaching by stories. That's one part of Zen that I have a love for. And in the Japanese craft of kintsugi, they take broken pottery and they glue the pottery back together, and then they put gold or silver or porcelain in the cracks. Maybe you've seen it, because it's starting to, Americans are starting to see it. Can you see this picture? Yeah. Let me show this, the people there. And actually, they say that the refurbished pot is often more beautiful than the original pot. And I have felt that this book kind of did that for me. I took all of my split off parts that come from trauma, the parts of myself I hated, or the parts of myself I had stuffed down, and I brought them up. And through, now that I'm practiced for so long, I do have a sense now of kindness. I do have a sense of the higher energies, I call them the nectar, spiritual nectar, coming down and helping me understand unconditional love. And I've done a lot of loving kindness practice and psychic heart practice and all these things we've been practicing. And I feel like I kind of put myself back together through love, 80%. And I'm blown away that after 50 years in Buddhism, I can say that. But it's not just Buddhism. It's all these different modalities that I had to integrate in order to find a healing for myself. And I could say also that I think this is what's happening in our society or in our culture, is that there's a lot of shattered pottery, that the vessel of America is kind of shattered. And I pray, or I hope, that we can glue it back together and the gold be kindness or love. So I'd like to end with offering the merit. And I'll just say one of the chapters in the book, the second chapter, is about my dock retreat. So, do I still have time? Yes. I left a sangha that I thought was breaking down ethically, and I had helped start it, and I was one of the main teachers. So it totally broke my heart to leave. I was shattered and filled with grief. And I didn't know what to do with myself. I lost my Sangha. I lost my teaching position. Oh, my friends are here who went through it with me. So I thought, well, all these old dudes, these old guys that we hear about, went up and practiced by themselves and outside. So I decided I was going to do that. I had two young children in elementary school. I had a big suburban house, but we had a pond in the backyard. And for some reason, it was like down in a valley. You couldn't see any houses. So it was a little bit of wilderness. And we had one wood dock. So I think it was almost 4 years, maybe even 5 years, that I sat on the dock by myself. I did it in training periods, so 2 or 3 months in the spring and in the fall. And that I live in Minnesota, so in the summer, it's the bugs are too bad and it's too hot. So, you know, May to mid-June and end of August through September through maybe mid-October, you can sit outside. And I would get up at 4:30 in the morning. And I remember you used to say, how do you get up? Why do you get up so early? And I would sit from like 5 to 7 on the dock in the dark. And I'd come in, get my kids ready. I'd send them off to school. And then I'd sit from 9 to noon. And then the rest of the day was off. So this is all described in the book. But what I did is in Zen, this is also this bias towards transcendence and bias for emptiness. In Zen, everything is black. Everything's a monotone, like when we chant is, because that's the emptiness, no melody, you know. So I decided to put our merit offering song, prayer, to song. And I made up this song. And I would sing it, and I used to call my sangha raccoons and turtles and what were it, muskrats. I had so, if you sit outside and you're quiet, all the animals come out. It's really, really cool. So, and all the stars come out. It was a, I wish I could do it again. It never, the causes and conditions of those years never came around again. Anyway, this is the song that I made up when I was sitting on the dock and at the end of my sittings. I'm falling apart here. Okay. May the merit of this penetrate into each and everything and all places, so that we and the world together may realize the Buddha way. I'd love to read you another koan about kintsugi. Would you like to say something? Okay. And this is also, you know, there's a beautiful book called The Hidden Lamp that has 100 koans of women. And then they were so brilliant. Susan Moon, and I forget the name of the second author. They, you know, the feminist historians researched and got 100 koans. And then they took 100 contemporary women teachers to do the commentary. Very nice. And that is, in Zen, we have these collections of koans, but first of all, they're 99.9% men. And second, usually it's one man who does all the commentary. So to have it be a collection of women was also very radical. And so a lot of the koans that I'm talking are in the book are from Hidden Lamp. So I want to talk to you about the authentic tea bowl before birth. So this is a koan, what was your face before you were born, right? That's kind of a common koan, that popular koan. And in that koan, do you feel the bias towards emptiness in the koan itself? So this is a little bit about breaking that bias. Moonheart, a Zen student, had prepared in great detail a tea ceremony for her teacher, Abbess Echo. She had cleaned the tea house, arranged a just-picked flower, found the teapot, boiled the water, and contemplated what sweet to offer. Moonheart decided to use a special antique tea bowl, a precious gift that the abbess herself had given her. Near the beginning of the tea ceremony, a Dharma sister of the abbess, Mushin, stopped by and was invited to join them. She was considered a wild woman and carried a bone as her teaching stick. Do you know that we Zen people have a teaching stick? And hers was a bone. So that's the great is the matter of life and death. And always to be aware that you're going to die. So how are you living your life? So she carried a bone. And a wild woman, do you have that in Theravadan Buddhism? These are people who are enlightened, but they just travel around. They do crazy wisdom, they call it in the Tibetan teachings. So this is kind of a crazy wild woman who carries a bone as her teaching stick. Right in the middle of the ceremony, Mushin smashed the tea bowl with her bone and scattered it to pieces on the floor. Everything, every thought stood still. Moonheart nearly fainted. Mushin exclaimed, "Now look at the authentic tea bowl that exists before birth." So this is a beautiful and wonderful example of going up, of the transcendent aspect of opening up form, opening up manifest reality, and showing you emptiness. Things come and go, let go. Right, okay, smash. A few moments later, Abbess Echo calmly responded, "I gave you this tea bowl, but now I would like you to give it back to me. Before you do, gather up the pieces, glue them back together, and fill the cracks with gold. Name this new bowl the authentic tea bowl before birth." Yeah. So that's a completely 360, 180, whatever that is, that the glued back together form is also emptiness. And that's in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. But if I may say, Buddhism leans towards emptiness. And I think women coming in, we can't afford to lean towards emptiness because we birth the whole world. And when you birth the whole world, you have to clean the high chair. You know, you have to work three jobs. That makes me cry. I did not have to work three jobs because of my position in society. But many people, and some of you, might have to work three jobs to feed your kids. So we can't afford to just be talking about emptiness. And the highest level for me of enlightenment is returning to delusion. That's what Dogen who is a very important old 13th century Zen teacher, says, how do you express your wisdom in your behavior? That's the main issue. And that's what I love. That's my intention. If I have a wise intention, is I want to express my understanding in my behavior, and I want to express my understanding in my speech. And from nine bodies, you would say, you want to come back to the manifest bodies and have them completely integrated with all the consciousnesses. So, okay, unless someone else wants to say something, we'll end. Anybody? I'll just say hi, Lois. another friend is on the Zoom. She's in Minneapolis. So I would just like to say something as a salesman. I'm going to be selling books if you'd like to buy a book. If you're online and want to buy a book, you can order it in any bookseller. But if you would like a signed copy or a 20% discount, you can go on my website, www.judithregeer.org, and order from there. And write me a review on Amazon. Okay, so...
Can I say a couple words?
Yes, please.
All right, before you leave, just a couple words about, just first of gratitude for all the people who helped make this evening possible. Cheryl, who set up all the AV and hybrid work. Ken online, who set up the meeting. And Kathy, who did the tech support. And two volunteers, Cuba and Meg. So thank you all. It was all volunteer organizations, so we really appreciate your support. And also thank you, Judith, for coming and offering these great teachings. I think it's an important voice that you're bringing to the Dharma. So I appreciate that. And I'm going to direct all our teachers to listen to these talks.
Thank you.
Yeah, they could be very important. And Judith also needs your support as her livelihood as a teacher. So Kathy, if you could put online the way to donate to Judith. There's a Venmo account. And here in person, there's a basket for cash, her checks, also Venmo information. So all those things, this tradition really relies on teachers offering their teachings in a really free way, in a very open way, in a generous way. And it also really relies on our support as students, as practitioners, to support the teacher in return. So, give what's appropriate for you. Each person has their own means, but try to reflect that you're not only giving for tonight, but also her whole livelihood and also the whole livelihood of the tradition. So thank you for your generosity and thank you for attending.